Welcome to another edition of The List, the Right Fiction Podcast. We've got a great show for you all today about our favorite prog rock albums. Before we get started, if you love the pod, please take a moment to rate, review it, and subscribe on your listening app. It helps us reach new listeners like you. Also, be sure to check out our companion Spotify playlist with all our picks that we mentioned in the pod. The link is in the show details. Now, on to the show. Progressive rock, also known as prog rock, joined the musical fray in the late 1960s as a new offshoot from the waning psychedelic scene. The music was based around elaborate compositions, virtuosic instrumentation, and lyrics that were more akin to a fantasy novel. Some would frame it as a rock and roll interpretation of classical music, but only in the idea of songs as movements, and not so much from musical ideas from the classical era. Was also a pivot away from the traditional, more dancey rock and roll, and was more of a listening music. While prog rock generally challenges the listener to actively stay engaged, there has been no shortage of devout fans to the genre, and specifically to their favorite bands such as Yes, Emerson, Lake & Palmer, Genesis, and King Crimson. However, on the flip side, over the years, the critics and the wider music listening audience hasn't embraced prog rock quite the same as the super fans of the genre. These critics labeled it as pretentious and overindulgent, and barring a few artists breaking through, most prog acts have lived perpetual existences as cult bands. Should it be this way, though? Should more people revisit and explore prog rock for themselves? Well, honestly, I don't know. But I'm excited to find out as today we discuss our favorite prog rock albums and why we love them. So hang out with us for a bit and see if our list matches yours. And with that, on to the show. And before we start the show, I'd like to introduce our very first guest, Mr. David Cope. Yes, David. David Cope. David is an amazing musician and prolific songwriter from Philly. His compositions reflect a broad array of styles, from pop and rock songwriting to classical to South Indian classical music and more. In the summer of 2012, Dave released his debut album, Davy Cope and the English Breakfast, a proper record. Since then, Dave has expanded his output, writing music for plays, television, and film. He's had many fantastic projects over the years, including Le Bon Bon, Fantasy Square Garden, and Dave Cope and the Sass. And the pandemic hasn't slowed him down either, releasing two new albums in the past couple months based on themes of life during the pandemic, in addition to some classical music as well. You can check out all his music on his Bandcamp page, davecope.bandcamp.com. And we'll put the link to his music in the show details for everyone to check out his music. David, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here, and thank you for having me.
Yes. And also, we got the other knuckleheads on the show. Of course, you know them. We got Adam, Brendan, and Freddie. And because we're talking about prog rock today, I'm actually going to sit this one out because, hey, prog rock. Okay, now we're going to give our picks for our favorite prog rock albums. David.
Yes.
Your number three pick, sir.
All right, for my number three pick, I'm choosing King Crimson's album, In the Court of the Crimson King. It was recorded in 1969 on Island Records, and it is one of the defining albums of the prog rock genre. It is considered one of the best by multiple critic sources as well. And yeah, it's one of my favorites because it's got a real dynamic range on it, and the songwriting is also pretty solid in addition to the sort of the musicianship.
That's an excellent pick, sir. Freddie, what do you got?
Yeah, so you guys know I don't really do third, second, first. Today, I'm just going to go by chronological order. So the first album I'm going to talk about came out in November 1970. It's Emerson, Lake & Palmer's debut record. Made a very heavy impact on me. as a 14-year-old little drummer boy trying to copy Carl Palmer's crazy playing. And I think it influenced a lot of musicians for better or for worse during.
I definitely want to hear both sides of that coin there too.
Okay. During the early 70s, absolutely. Emerson, Lake and Palmer, self-titled album, November 20th, 1970.
Nice. Mr. Adam.
Before I throw my pick, I thought those first two choices have an excellent parallel, as Greg Lake is on both of them. So that's an interesting start.
Yes, correct.
Yeah, because, we'll get into the King Crimson revolving cast of characters. But yeah, I mean, Greg Lake was the singer on Court of the Crimson King, which kind of opened the door for a lot of prog. But I picked my first choice here, or my number three, or however you want to put it. I'm going to play the no numbers thing here because mine are all over. But it's more near the end of the traditional prog era, and I picked Genesis's The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway, the one that broke the Peter Gabriel era of Genesis. Yeah. He really, I mean, for this one, it's almost like a solo album for him. He tried to tackle everything himself. I mean, like lyric wise, and had this huge high concept, kind of, you know, the story Rail, the Puerto Rican youth, almost like a West Side Story parallels all twisted out. And why this makes my list is there's, while it is it's considered a quote unquote flawed masterpiece, which I think it is. There's some great songs on it. I mean, it is a little dense, but I kind of feel like this was like Peter Gabriel's last stab at prog, because if you look at his solo career, he did not even scratch the surface of trying to do this type of thing again. I think he burned himself on it. It was very theatrical. And anyone that listens to this pod knows we talk about Peter Gabriel every day of our lives as much as we can. So, you know, he has to be represented.
Speak
in here.
Speak for yourself.
Lamb Lies Down, number three.
All right, Brendan, what do you got, man?
Thanks, guys. My number third pick, I'm going with a little band called ELO. And the album that I chose for this particular topic was El Dorado, which was from 1974, which I thought was the most fitting. ELO perhaps is prog adjacent, but I think El Dorado is definitely a prog record. And to me, it sounds like what would happen if the Beatles made a prog record. Just the way that it goes through everything. It's high concept from top to bottom. And I love Jeff Lynne's production style. And I think it's executed beautifully. It's like kind of a watching a movie as you listen to an album.
Very interesting. Yeah. His voice always reminds me of John Lennon. It's uncanny. David, what's your number two pick, man?
My number two pick, I guess I'll choose Fragile by Yes. Close to the Edge. My bad. Close to the Edge. Sorry. Hold on. Close to the Edge.
Fragile is good too.
Fragile is good. And we could talk about that in some degree. Fragile, I mean, Close to the Edge was released in 1972. To me, having listen to a lot of Yes's early stuff, I'm not as familiar with their later stuff, but in terms of their early stuff, I feel like this was really a distillation or a compounding of their earlier attempts at an album. And I think it's really consistent and coherent. Again, there are like three tracks on the album, I think. So that really, the first track is like 18 minutes long. It's the entire length of a side. And then the other two tracks on the other side. So these are very long musical movements, they consist of, it's like really kind of a super group of the prog world. You got John Anderson, Steve Howe, Rick Wakeman, Bill Bruford, these just really phenomenal players. And it was a very difficult record to make, I've heard too. So you can tell it's very ambitious and it's really kind of a quintessential prog album as well. So there you go.
Nice pick.
All right.
Mr. Fred.
Yeah.
What's up, man?
So I just want to say something real quick. You know, one of the things about prog rock, and maybe we'll touch on this as we go, is the personnel in a lot of these bands was just so huge. It never really stayed the same from record to record. So that's one thing why you can have, you know, one reason why you can have several bands mentioned within a pod, but it's basically not really the same band. You can consider a different band. Anyway, my second pick was actually released a week after my first pick, November 27th, 1970.
Working in a tight window.
Yeah, right? No, well, different band. Gentle Giant's debut album. And great band, very underrated, in my opinion. Actually saw them. I've seen a lot of these bands. Gentle Giant was composed of three brothers and a friend. And a couple of the brothers, I believe, went on to have big careers in the music business and the Shulman brothers. Anyway, just a real quick aside before I move on. Turns out Sherman Hemsley, the actor, was a huge fan of Gentle Giant.
Which makes no sense.
I remember hearing about that. Yeah.
Yeah, from Jefferson, George Jefferson. Yeah, anyway, that's my number two pick. That was nice. Rambling.
Adam.
I don't remember George Jefferson ever spinning any Gentle Giant in the living room.
Hey, Wheezy, put on that Gentle Giant.
I went a little, but no, I have more on Gentle Giant later. But my number two, I stepped a little outside the traditional era prog box and went with Tool's Enema from '96. Now this is kind of, I think they went into the, it's considered more prog metal, so to speak. But Tool is they're always very deliberate in their packaging of their songs and their length. And there's a lot of great musicians, a lot of great. Danny Carey. I mean, you know, in prog you need good drummers, and Danny Carey is up there on my favorites. And this is just one of those albums in high school that kind of like, it's not like the traditional prog bands weren't. I mean, they carried over some amongst musicians and everything, but Tool kind of like. The Tool broke through. This is a triple platinum album. This is kind of, I mean, it really broke through, and it kind of pulled from some of like the Rush audience. Once again, you get another, prog drummer. And once again, I picked another like hour and 15 minute album here, but I mean, with prog, you need to take the time, and you take the time. This is a great album, and I've known it for years. Number Tool, Enema.
Hey, speaking of Enema, Brendan.
Thank you so much. What an introduction. I'll be here all week, guys.
TMI.
So for my second pick, I think I win the award for most recent. So this may be subject for argument on part two. But I went with this band called Midlake. And I remember having a moment. I saw them live a few years ago. And I'm listening to them. And I didn't know them that well. I'd heard maybe a couple tunes. And I had a moment in the middle of the concert. I was like, they're a prog band. It just struck me as that. They just had all of the elements of prog. And I think maybe if we may coin the term indie prog, that may be the closest thing that I can put as a label for them. But anyway, I picked their record Antiphon, which is from 2013. And it just takes you on that journey. There's like cool synths. There's like very sort of cerebral vocal and vocal effects and vocal lyrical things that are happening that I think are interesting. And it's I think it's right out of the same page of some of the more proper Queen's prog from England in the 70s. So that's my number two.
Nice, nice.
Yeah.
All right, here we are. Our top picks, our top prog album picks. David Cope.
My number one pick is Jethro Tull and their album Thick as a Brick. Not Sick as a Brick. It was the fifth album they made, studio album that is. And it was basically a response to the critical response to their earlier album Aqualung, where critics thought that was a concept record and kind of a prog rock record. So Jethro Tull decided to make an actual concept record, you know, to sort of, you know, joke around a little bit. And the result was Thick as a Brick, which is, you know, another one of these albums where it just, you know, goes all the way through, basically, nonstop music. And it's an interesting, I'll get to the sort of the plot of it later. It basically revolves around this fictitious idea of a little child genius who's written this poem that Jethro Tull has set to music. And a lot of people believe this was true. In fact, the album cover is like a newspaper clipping, a front page of a newspaper, which talks about this very story that they're talking about in the album. So, you know, if you weren't in on the joke, you kind of might have thought that it was a real deal situation where this little kid had written this poem that had been set to music by Ian Anderson and the guys in the band. And, you know, I was a big fan of Jethro Tull. I wasn't as big a fan of their proggier stuff, but I thought I'd put this in anyway just because of my special place in my heart for this band. So there you go.
Nice. Fred.
All right. Yeah, and for my third and final pick, I am choosing a record that came out in October 6th, 1972, fourth album by Genesis called Foxtrot.
Yeah.
And I actually saw this. I saw them perform this tour.
Oh, my God.
At the Tower Theater.
Wow.
It was mind-blowing. But again, like I said,
or was your mind already blown at that time?
It was, but there was a little bit of both going on, I will admit. But as I said before, you know, that band compared to the band that went on to have huge arena success was two different animals. And Foxtrot was just probably the culmination of their, you know, inner workings as, you know, a quote-unquote premier prog rock band. Watcher of the Skies, Supper's Ready. I mean, that alone is just, you know, worth the price of admission. So anyway, that's my third and final pick.
Nice.
Genesis, Foxtrot.
Adam, what's your number one pick, sir? Mm.
Another quick factoid of connective tissue while we're doing the quick album thing here. Watcher on the Skies, Foxtrot is right up there with Lamb for me, but you can only pick three. But the Mellotron on that is the Mellotron from Court of the Crimson King. Like they King Crimson had sold or gave, probably sold it to Genesis because they're like, after hearing that album, like, oh my God, we need something like that. But they kind of had to pick the key for Watcher on the Sky. Because the Mellotron was kind of, there was tuning problems, only so many keys worked, so they kind of had to pick the thing that sounded the best. So there's just another connective tissue amongst the fraternity of Prague. And speaking of that, my number one is also in that fraternity, and I picked King Crimson's Red, which is the end of the second iteration of King Crimson, however you want to put it. Another connective tissue is the drummer on here is my favorite prog drummer who was on Close to the Edge?
Yes.
Bill Bruford, yeah.
Yeah. His last record.
Yeah, he left after to join King Crimson. Yeah. Yeah. But man, I mean that Red just hits hard. It's a power trio. They just Fripp is his darkest and dirtiest ever. I mean, Starless is just a masterpiece of a song and I saw him at the latest iteration of King Crimson at the Merriman a couple years ago, and they did like most of this album that day, and that made my day. That's my number one.
Nice. And we're closing it down. Number one pick, Brendan, what do you got?
Okay. All right, guys. So maybe I'm showing my hand a little bit because my picks are perhaps arguably prog adjacent, so maybe you can already get a sense of my feelings on the genre. But I struggled with this topic, and I was just thinking, like, all right, what makes a great prog record? It has to be theatrical, it has to have experimental production techniques, it has to have odd time signatures, synthesizers, all that sort of stuff. And then this epiphany came. Guys, Dark Side of the Moon, And so I feel like maybe I'm going to be stoking the flame a little bit in part two, but I feel like that guy from the memes with his like sitting in the chair with his arms folded, like Dark Side of the Moon is the greatest prog rock record of all time, changed my mind.
Right. Nice. On. You're
and
not
on
wrong.
That note,
it's actually rated that... number one in the Rolling Stones like best prog rock albums.
Oh, it is. Okay.
There you go.
Number one. Yeah, I was looking them up. Yeah, I was seeing which one. But yeah, that's definitely considered like a. It's not as flashy, you know, as the other stuff, but it's yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I guess the it gets claimed a little more in the psychedelic realm. So yeah, that's why. Yeah.
Yeah.
But right. To discuss in part two, it does seem like Pink Floyd sidesteps the prog label somehow a little bit, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. To be continued. But that they seem to sidestep it. And why is that coming up?
Tasty preview. We're going to go for a break, guys. And we'll be back in a second with all the juicy details. We'll be back. Welcome back to the discussion portion of our pod here, where we talk about all the picks you just heard about. And today, the picks today were very interesting. And I know the guys have a lot of different feelings on prog rock and what it means. And so I kind of wanted to start at the beginning. So as someone who is not totally familiar with the genre or the bands, I want to kick it to the guys and say, like, so what exactly... How do you define prog rock? Freddie, how do you define prog rock?
Well, I would have to choose some of the description that you read in the intro that definitely self-indulgent would be one of the characterizations. Virtuosity in the playing is definitely another. For the most part, these guys are all great players. That's two. Self-indulgent. And then the other thing, I guess, would be, and it probably doesn't apply to everything, but a lot is a lot of conceptual songs. The writing is very conceptual, as opposed to I want to hold your hand, or I love you, baby. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like high art.
And actually, I have a follow-up question for you, Freddie. So I know you're a lyric guy, right?
Yeah.
So when these bands are talking about gnomes and, like, and you know, mystical creatures, as a lyric guy, doesn't that make you cringe?
Well, when you're a 14-year-old boy, and you're trying to expand your mind on a daily basis, this stuff is right up your alley, man.
I hear you. And Adam, I'll kick that same question to you. Like, how do you define, prog rock?
Well, I mean, I don't know about the long form thing, the conceptual thing. I think just trying to, I guess, you know, like one concise message or one like tied together message thing. I don't know. There's not really much I can really add to that, Aaron. You know, as we are learning, as we do more of these, the subgenres in the eye of the beholder. I mean, I threw Tool in there. I mean, and Tool, I mean, they're, I mean, if you're going to go, you know, right to the letter of the law, like prog rock was like 1969 to 1977 until punk murdered it. But I think the prog tradition kind of continually seen you listening to Midlake. I was just kind of like, okay, I see this. And the description of Midlake, what was it? It was like the guys are Radiohead fans trying to play Jethro Tull. And I'm just like, huh. And that's a very prog ish concept. I mean, it's really just having that overlying arc theme and a little bit of overplaying.
And what about you, David? Like, do you kind of agree with what Adam and kind of Freddie were talking about with the virtuosic thing, with the just, you know, all that kind of description?
Absolutely. And I think Adam brought up a good point about the relationship to punk. I think, you know, you can define prog rock as what it is and what it's not. You know, I think in some ways prog rock was kind of a culmination of this idea that rock could be more, quote unquote, than just the 3-minute pop song. And, you know, that really led to a lot of backlash. You know, a lot of young kids were like, I want to play music too. And I don't want to have to be like, you know, Emerson, Lake and Palmer or Yes and play like a 10-minute, like, you know, drum solo or keyboard solo here and there. I just want to pick up my guitar and express myself. And that sort of led to that whole punk movement, which I think in some ways gets a lot more glory than the prog rock stuff does. I mean, there's sort of a kind of a heroic aspect that a lot of people try and, you know, describe the punk movement as a sort of, you know, this rebellion against prog rock, you know, and whether that's, you can't say whether that's, you know, anything justified or not, but you can see the reasons, you can see where that would lead certain listeners probably to become alienated. But, you know, in the early 70s, I mean, if you're a kid listening to that stuff, it's got to be mind blowing. You know, that stuff, it's a lot of energy and a lot of effort put into making those kinds of albums that are very, very musically sophisticated, and very, you know, very impressive. I mean, it's really impressive. Knowing how hard it is to record like a 2-minute song well, you know, to do that on tape, you know, on tape back then. I mean, that, you know, now nowadays Midlake and those guys are probably using Pro Tools and you know, whatever, and they probably can cheat a little,
right?
And we all can. But back then, you know, and that's the whole reason, you know, speaking of, that's the whole reason we were talking about why the personnel maybe changed so much. Like, probably being around the same guys doing that kind of stressful stuff, you're like, I gotta get away from this. Like, the Rupert's like, John, get away from me right now with your vegetarian. I gotta be with King Crimson or something, you know? It's like,
that's exactly what happened with Bill Bruford.
Yeah, exactly.
By the time they finished recording Close to the Edge, he was done.
Yeah,
I actually saw that tour, the Close to the Edge tour.
Wow.
And Bruford was not in the band. I was Alan White's first tour, and it was a very interesting bill at the Spectrum. It was JoJo Gunn, which featured a couple of ex-members of Spirit. JoJo Gunn, the Eagles,
three famous.
They were amazing. And then, yes, Close to the Edge.
That's unbelievable. That's amazing.
That's how it used to be back then.
That's a weird bill.
Wow.
Crazy.
Wow.
But yeah, David, you make some good points. It was very impressive.
Yeah.
Music.
And so I want to bring in Brendan here as you know, usually Brendan is our resident whatever guy, or jazz guy, or this guy, or that guy, or this guy, or the other guy.
Resident guy.
I got a guy. He's our guy. But you're not our guy on this one. So, you know, when you talk, when the other guys are talking about how, you know, their feelings are on prog and, you know, where it comes from and, you know, the components of it. I guess, why didn't those components and those kind of ingredients hit you like them?
I've been trying to figure this out because I studied our Spotify playlist. I was really trying to connect with a lot of these albums, and most I did, because like, I love psychedelic music. I love synthesizers. I love challenging music. I'm down for all of that. But my overarching attitude upon listening to many of this, particularly the Genesis records, and like, I love Peter Gabriel, and I'll say, well, I have respect for Phil Collins, but like, I'm listening to it, and the first thing that comes to mind is like, guys, get on with it. Yeah. Just get on with it.
get on with what, though?
It doesn't go anywhere for me. It just becomes, I mean, self-indulgence is certainly on the nose. It's just like, what are we doing? Where are we going? Why are we going there?
Yeah, I agree with you, Brendan. I wouldn't consider myself a Prague aficionado either, but I agree with that. Like, it's hard to listen to something like that. It's a different thing than classical music too, in that that kind of arc, that long arc of music, you really have to know what you're doing to do that in a way that is engaging the whole time, right? I mean, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And that's real, you know. It's also, sorry, I don't mean to be.
No, go ahead, man. Go deep. Go. This is prog rock, baby. This is prog rock.
Yeah.
Go deep.
Yeah.
You know,
the second movement.
Yeah. There's a lot of, here's the thing, having tried to do both of these kinds of things, there is an equal challenge in writing a 3-minute song that is completely engaging the whole time as there is in writing a 20-minute, you know, side of an album. With that, and even in classical stuff, you have a lot more freedom. You can put anything you want into that area. You know, you can kind of choose, you know, as it's gotten, you know, with the shorter forms of music, you know, in order to do it successfully, the focus has to be really, you know, distilled and really good. So both are challenges, but the prog rock thing can be less rewarding to the listener. I agree. I think that's true.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. And I kind of want to bring up something that's, I guess, tangential. So when I was listening to the Spotify playlist, the prog rock Spotify playlist, I heard some things that I thought were cool. And then it just kept going, I guess. And then I thought to myself, I just want to listen to Weather Report right now. And so when we talk about where I'm going is the virtuosic thing, right? So if prog rock is known as the virtuosic genre of music, how is it virtuosic in relation to, you know, Return to Forever or Mahavishnu Orchestra, or, you know, because these things are kind of happening concurrently.
Good point.
What do you think? What do you think, Freddie?
I wouldn't say they were happening concurrently.
Okay.
I believe that prog rock was first of all, the fusion players were coming more from a jazz background as opposed to the prog players.
Yeah, they were coming from jazz, but they were going into the rock realm.
Yeah, 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 totally. Right? But it's a different kind of skill set.
Right, a virtuosic skill set, right?
Virtuosic nonetheless, but different.
Okay.
Different. And I believe, in my opinion, that the prog rock thing kind of overall was happening first, in my opinion. And the fusion kind of followed, not far behind, but, you know, the peak was later.
Huh.
But that's not to say that some of the prog rock players couldn't play jazz and vice versa, but I just think therein lies the difference.
Brendan, what do you got, Brendan?
Well, I'm going to answer your question with another question, but I don't know, and maybe you guys have more insight into this. Why does the bulk of Prague in its height, in its the peak of Prague, come from England? And maybe that's a reason, because I feel like Prague was like filtered through sort of like Renaissance folk music and psychedelic music, and you get Prague somehow. But jazz is not a part of that.
Right.
I wonder if that speaks to like the class issues in England, sort of this idea in the upper classes that classical music was, you know, more sophisticated, and you had a lot of guys playing rock, you know, working class guys who were, you know, like the Beatles coming up, you know, from Liverpool or other places and wanting to prove themselves. I mean, or just wanting to say, you know, F you to those guys being like, you know, we can do this stuff too. Rock is just as viable a form of music as, you know, classical or as anything else. I mean, that's a conjecture. I have no idea, but you know, I would think that, you know, there's a story about like Paul McCartney being getting a ride in a taxi, and the guy's playing classical music, and he's like, oh, what's that? You know, he's like, oh, that's sophisticated stuff. You wouldn't be into that. And Paul McCartney's like, well, hey, come on, man. You know, I'm like Paul McCartney. I like, you know, follow up. But you know, that kind of idea, maybe that has something to do with it. I mean, you know, there is a difference in that sense. You know, but then you had Rush from Canada. I guess they were. I don't know. That was different.
Good point.
Different time. But is there a lot of American stuff? I mean, Dream Theater, but they're later too, right? I don't know if they're American. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm trying to.
Not really. And by the way, nobody picked Rush. Very interesting. It's a prog rock.
There's a vocal hang-up I have, especially in the early stuff. There's a little vocal hang-up. I love, I mean, God, you know, brilliant musicians, but, I mean, Geddy Lee needed to go down a notch there with those. Holy, holy, it's like a castrated.
Yeah. Hey, real quick, I just want to read
something.
You saw them
too? You saw them too? Oh, no, okay. I didn't see them.
I was never really a fan. I'm just doing some research here while we're talking. Apparently, there was a thing called the Canterbury scene or Canterbury sound, which is kind of one of the early influences of prog rock, a term describes a loosely defined improvisational style that blends elements of jazz, rock, and psychedelia.
Huh.
And these influences help make up the early influences of prog rock with groups like Soft Machine, Caravan.
Yeah.
So
great. Yeah.
So there you go.
And that's the other thing is that I think, you know, there was a band like called Gong with the Australian David Allen. And that's considered prog rock, but that's like kind of quirky, and it's not exactly like the virtuosic, pretentious stuff. It's just kind of weird. And like Amon Dool, that German band. It's not the same. I guess there are stereotypes about what prog rock is, but it can also, I guess, just be. I mean, Sgt. Pepper is almost prog rock in a way, you know, in that sense that it's kind of progressive, trying to progress something, you know. And then we get into the illusion of progress later, I guess. But like that's, you know, that's something else. But you know,
that's a great point. That's something I've actually been thinking about is when we're talking about prog rock. And I was doing a little research before the show, and I was starting to think about like, how is this not like the Beatles, like, you know, Revolution, was it Revolution 9 or whatever, or like. Was, you know, all these kind of like weirdo songs that they had, but and I love them. So I was like, how can I love that, but I can't really love this? And the answer that I came to myself is, well, those explorations were right between something or, you know, what's that song?
Here comes the sun.
Yeah, Here Comes the Sun or something. I'm like, oh, okay, that's why I can like them, because it's like I'm tethered to the real world.
It's tempered.
Yeah, I'm tethered to like something like solid that I can like feel and in touch. But these other albums are kind of like way out there. One of you guys, Brendan, you wanted to say something about that? Is that right? Or
Adam, that was me. And doing this, you know, I mean, I've been listening to quote unquote prog forever, but you do your little, you start doing your Wikipedia digging and everything. And a phrase came out to me where like, they're talking about, like where prog rock was like trying to bring like the sophisticated deck to like the working class, kind of like bringing high and low crowds together. And I kept on seeing that coming back, and I'm like, I don't understand that. Like, I feel like it, if anything, it's like guys that aren't as, they're not non-aristocratic guys trying to play aristocratically and like basically like alienating an audience in the process. Although saying it comes along, you know, musicians do like the proggy stuff because they're like guys that can play tricky and fast. So that's why there's always been kind of an audience. But I'm just like, I just don't see how they prog brought anything together, and more just kind of like it was just an answer to the meandering of psychedelia where we're gonna go just as long, but we're gonna be, you know, we're gonna try to be, you know, sophisticated about it.
Right.
Yeah, I agree with that. And also thinking about this topic that we're talking about here today is one thing. I've been watching. You ever seen the classic albums from VH1 where they did? So there was one for Peter Gabriel's album. So, and he had I think it was the bass player or somebody that was like with them in Genesis or played around with them. He said, yeah, back in the day, like when we were doing Genesis, there was just like no girls. And then when this album came out, there was girls and it was awesome. I loved it.
That makes total sense.
Yeah.
I think that was like a key ingredient to why, you know, the genre, whatever it happened to be, didn't like flourish forward. Because I'm not sure there was many girls out there at the shows.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
That makes total sense. Yeah, I mean, think about it.
Yeah, if you're playing for yourself, I mean, the pop music is gets close because you're talking to the girl. I mean, you're saying, you know, love me do, you know, she loves you, you know, it's all about you're conversing with the girls. You're talking to them. And with this stuff, true, it's like, like in the Shire of Frodo, where we all go, it's like, you think, come on. I mean, some girl. I mean, hey, maybe some girls are into that stuff, but the majority of people in general, are not, probably not going to respond to that. It's just not going to grab them necessarily. And also, you know, music is one thing, lyrics are another a lot of the time. And when you combine them in songs, it's like a beautiful union. But a lot of people don't listen to the music like musicians do. You know, for prog rock is like for musicians to listen to, like, oh my God, did you hear that sus chord he put in right there and all this? I'm like, you know, your average listener is going to be listening to like the lyric and want to hear what the lyric says to them, you know, and how it speaks to them.
Freddie, what's up, man?
Yeah. I think, just reacting to what David said, I think Led Zeppelin got it right because they were talking about Frodo and the depths of Mordor, but with a sexy beat. So there was girls, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think they split the difference. They got it right. And by the way, I was wrong about the jazz fusion was kind of happening concurrently. Late 60s, you know, around the same time as prog rock, just instead of in the UK, it was happening in the States. So I was wrong. Sorry.
Adam, so what's up, man?
I got something here, and this is for Brendan, because we can't leave you alone here. Okay, because this is going to, because you're going to have to go with, so you said the get on with it thing. And now when you listen to Miles Davis's Bitches Brew, are you just like, get on with it the whole time?
That's a good question.
I don't want to tease what could potentially be a future episode, but for some reason, no, because there's a story being told in a way that connects with me through the horn, through those instruments on that record.
Plus, they're really good at playing music.
So yeah, good.
Really good at it. It's so
they're very virtuosic.
And perhaps groove. I guess there's got to be some sort of groove happening. And I think so much prog doesn't.
Right.
It's like organic too. It just feels so alive, that music, and it's so much feeling in it. The prog stuff is. Even with its sort of expansiveness, it seems contained by a certain set of harmonic and melodic rules that don't let it jump out of that world.
Also the personnel, if they keep jumping on and the instruments, personnel that keep, you know, going back and forth to the different bands, it's like self-contained, like you were saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I know we're not talking about our picks a lot this week. One, because I had a hard time. I'll be honest with you guys. I had a hard time listening to these picks. I was just like,
it was hard to get through.
I listened to like 2 minutes of like each one, and I was like, man, like, give me some Return of Forever or like some, you know, My Spanish Heart or something, or you know, some Jaco or something. But there was one pick that I really enjoyed. But it's not really totally prog. That Midlake M. Antiphon album, I really enjoyed that album. I was like, yeah, this is cool, but it's not really prog, I guess. So, and then the ELO one, I was like, yeah, Mr. Blue Sky, but then I was like, well, it's not on that record, so I don't care. So as far as like your picks go, are any of these picks that anyone else picked that you were like, yeah, I really like that, or that showed me something new, or you know what, after seeing everyone's picks, you know, prog is just like a bunch of crap. Is any kind of feeling
is that yours? Is that what this, I think that's your take right now.
Brendan, what do you say?
Yeah, well, just a quick response to you. I'm glad you liked the Midlake. I think they're really underrated, and it may connect for you because they are very song forward. I think maybe that's the breaking point for the prog part of it, even though I still hear them as a modern prog band. Members of that band have backed like Israel Nash and Father John Misty. Like, they're very much informed by pop music. So maybe that's why it was something that connected with you. But yeah. Anyway, what I wanted to say was there was one gem in here that stood out to me that I didn't know. It was The Gentle Giant. And I thought it was a delightful record. And for some reason, that one was really connected with me.
I really like that one too.
Right on.
I really like that. Yeah.
What about that album? Like, for you, David, like, what about that album really kind of got you?
Well, the thing about this was, you know, getting to listen to it all, like, because all the songs are so like getting through it. So when that came on, I was impressed by the musicianship, and it was melodic. There was good songs in there. It was good. And I was surprised. I never even really heard of it. And I was like, these guys are really good. You know, like, and you know, you know, to say specifically, you know, that's the other thing about the prog stuff is like to be able to internalize it. You know, with an album like Bitches Brew, you internalize it because the feeling is so constant and is there. And there's a feeling that you get. With the prog rock, there's ideas and ideas and ideas a lot of the time, it feels like. So yeah. getting to know that album, like, you know, I mean, even some of these albums I put, like the Jethro Tull album, I would turn it off a lot of the time when I was a kid. I was like, I didn't like it, you know? And so I'm just getting to know it now. And even now I'm kind of like, well, geez, like there's like at minute 23, there's like this weird thing that happens that I'd never heard. I mean, it's just, so there's a lot of information in there to digest. But the Gentle Giant stuff, I remember, you know, a first listen, second listen, I was like, this is nice. This is good. And it didn't seem like kind of a, you know, necessarily a prog thing, so to speak, in that it was, you know, all over the place or, you know, complex. So I liked it. Yeah, I like that one too.
Adam, what do you got, man?
I just wanted my quick thing on Gentle Giant and how quick side note for the vinyl people, aside from King Crimson and a little bit of Genesis, you can find a lot of these in the $2 bin. And that's how I do a lot of discovering in the $2 bin. Like, yes, I've gotten my entire Yes collection from the $2 bin. And
that tells you a lot.
I've gotten a lot of other good stuff there. I actually found a Shirley Bassey album in there that we were talking about from an earlier pod, and I enjoyed the heck out of that. That was great. Yeah. You find some great discoveries. But anywho, I did pick up in the $2 bin. I picked up a Gentle Giant record, not this particular one, but I picked up The Power and the Glory. It's like their fourth one, and it's just crazy fucking like angular. Like, I mean, like you're doing like multiple different like time signature changes right from the beginning, and I'm like listening to it, I'm like, this is jarring. And I put it on occasionally, but it's like, it's a bit of a turnoff just how jarring it is at the beginning. And then putting on this Gentle Giant album that I was not familiar with, I'm like, oh wow, it's not all weird. It's like it's like accessible from the start. I'm like, huh, I got to do a little more digging. You know, it's like, you know, a lot of album to album difference between the prog bands. I've seen a lot of lineup changes, a lot of like, if you really in given any prog band, you can't listen to one album and know their whole thing.
Yeah, that's true. And actually, because we put it all in a Spotify playlist format, I thought also it was very interesting to compare back and forth to each other. I thought that was an interesting way to kind of see the genre or whatever, like in full, and how different bands and different albums compare to each other, where the ones that might stand out a bit really do stand out because you just went through, you know, 5 hours of just not standout stuff. But speaking of one standout thing that I really I didn't mention also was Adam kind of put me on to The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway, that Genesis album. And I have to say there was like a lot of moments in that album that were really fantastic to me. A lot of melodies and you know, chords and the singing and all. It was really fantastic. However, I guess what was my response, Adam? It was something like,
"This is the longest album of all time."
Yeah, it was the longest album of all time, and I think I said, "You know what? If I didn't have, you know, any responsibilities at all,
and really high,
and I was really high, and I just could for like 2 weeks just like listen to this album, I would be in heaven." But that is not reality.
14-year-old boy.
Yeah.
If I was a 14-year-old boy. Yeah. Exactly. Boom. Yeah. So I guess that's what we really come down to is prog rock is for 14-year-old boys.
Wait, here's the point. Did it. Oh, go ahead, Adam. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I want to pose this question to everybody, but I'm going to send it to Dave first just because I can't tease it in the first segment and we just not get to it. And also, I think it is kind of an important question amongst us. I can't say we're really elevating prog on this as particular podcast, but I'll start with you, Dave. How has Pink Floyd seemed to avoid this stigma, at least in my opinion? Like, what is it about Pink Floyd's quote unquote prog that kind of like just rises above the majority of these other bands? I mean, even King Crimson's around, but it's still a geek status. Pink Floyd is like people's lives. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Every wall, every college dorm wall.
Yeah. I will say this. I will say, I think part of it has to do with, let's go back for a second to why these guys decided to maybe make this prog stuff, to challenge the conventions, to do this. You know, as someone who writes songs, you get tired of songs. You get tired of 3-minute songs a lot of the time. You know, it just happens with music. If you play something over and over again, unless that song is really, really, it really hits something, you know, really hits. And Pink Floyd has those songs, has some of those songs, like, you know, I mean, you know, Dark Side of the Moon has some pretty, pretty killer songs. And I'm not even the biggest fan of Pink Floyd songwriting necessarily, but I know that those songs touched a chord with people, you know, and that's a big deal in terms of sort of if your music lasts. Now, who knows? Maybe in 50 years, maybe the prog rock stuff will have some resurgence. People will think, oh, that Pink Floyd stuff was blah, blah, blah. Like, this prog rock stuff is really where it's at. But in terms of right now, yeah, I mean, songs like Comfortably Numb, these, you know, albums like The Wall, there are songs on there that, you know, and this is true for Yes too. Yes is on the classic rock station with some songs, but Yes's songs, you know, are about nothing. They're not about anything. The lyrics, if you listen to them, they're, you know, there might be a cool kind of play on words here and there and a cool kind of combination of words, but it doesn't mean anything. You can't, it's like stream of consciousness almost. And, you know, with Pink Floyd, there's a direct sort of intention behind it. It's also, and that goes also saying, you know, the music on Pink Floyd stuff is not as ambitious in a lot of ways. It's evocative.
Good point. Good point.
It's evocative and it's very, you know, it's transformative and it, you know, you close your eyes, it's cool, but it doesn't challenge the listener to not only pay attention for long periods of time to a vast array of notes and rhythms, but it also, you know, it invites you in, the songs compel you, and then it also takes you on a bit of a trip too. So it's this beautiful middle ground of being able to sort of, you know, get a little lifted, let's say, if you're a 14-year-old kid or a, you know, 15-year-old kid or a 17-year-old girl or whatever, but have the songs actually speak to you as well. I mean, lyrics are a huge, huge, huge deal with that stuff. Lyrics are a huge deal with that. And I mean, the same thing we're saying, like, you know, that why jazz is, you know, better or whatever, but jazz is all like, you don't find a lot of teenage girls listening to a lot of jazz either. I don't think, you know, you find people listening to stuff that talks to them in that way that they can understand in a verbal sense, I think, you know, and that's my opinion. I don't know.
Well, one thing I would say with the Pink Floyd thing is, so what is the opposite of gnomes and fairy tales and, you know, Mordor? The opposite of that? Money. Real as it gets.
Yeah, they were real. They were real. They talked about drug use and money and mental illness and
loneliness.
Yeah, loneliness, a lot of isolation. That's also, Bowie is like that too. Bowie got weird, but he talked about that stuff, and he was fantastical and whatever. But it wasn't all removed. It wasn't all in the headspace, you know. It was a union of all the different sort of chakras or whatever you want to call it. You know, I don't know.
Yeah, you bring the listener into the equation as when you're talking about these other albums, like, yeah. The listener is just like your inner head is the.
Well, I mean, those albums, you know, the music on the albums we posted, you know, it's not alienating necessarily. It's just that the arc of it is so much longer than we're used to. We're used to an arc that is like a 3-minute arc where you get to the chorus within like, you know, a minute. And then you have the chorus three times, and then you're out. You know, this is not that kind of arc. It's the same thing with classical music. You know, you have something like, you know, that's a piece that's 10 minutes to 20 minutes to 40 minutes long, you know? And like Beethoven gets boring sometimes if you're listening. For me, I get bored of it. Like in some symphonies, it's like, ugh.
Me too.
I mean, it's like, especially now here, this is, you know, especially like the, you know, that school of music. I mean, Beethoven was breaking rules, you know, But you know, you had that. There were like hundreds of like German composers in that time who were writing this kind of stuff that was so formulaic and so just the same thing, you know. And it gets old. And what I think we could, you know, you could talk about in addition to the Prague stuff. I was talking to Fred about this. Probably he's thinking I'm funny, but the French guys in the late 1800s, the like Debussy and Ravel and those guys. That's like Prague in a way that's amazing as well. But it's also compelling. And I find that stuff is not boring at all. That stuff is like transformative to me. And it's, you know.
Where were you? You should have been on our last episode.
Yeah, you talked about classical composers, which
audience, you can listen. I know more about that than I do about prog rock, probably. But
I'm sure it'll come around again, man. I'm sure it'll come around again. But I know we're coming up to the end here, guys. And I just wanted to see if there's any kind of you know, remaining thoughts or, you know, points you'd like to make with regards to prog rock. And I know, Adam, you're always my go-to guy for, you know, cleanup thoughts or anything. And then, you know, definitely welcome from Brendan as well as, you know, to hear how much you love prog rock as well. So, Adam, go ahead, man.
All right. Well, I guess to kind of put a bow on this, I think, let's see, prog would have to say it's definitely musicians' music, but not every musician, as we've learned, as we are all, you know, we like to call ourselves musicians here. But I think what we're seeing, we're like Pink Floyd kind of maybe did the great, they were maybe the blueprint for getting out of psychedelia and into prog, because they kind of, them, you know, them and Soft Machine kind of got it going. But I mean, they and Pink Floyd stuck around, but they did prog with it, you know, with the, you know, they kept the themes a little more simple. And I think that's what happens a lot. I think the word you need here for prog is density. It's dense. The lyrics are dense. The guitar lines are dense. The keyboards are dense. The drums are every, you know, how many piece kits they're, you know, they're like cruise ships. I mean, it's like, it's I think you have to have an ear for the density to enjoy. Cause I enjoy prog a lot. I don't just put it on. Like, I'm not putting it on to start my day. It's a little intense, but I still find moments for it. And I think, time will tell how much more it gets compartmentalized, down the line. I think maybe in like 100 years, it's just going to be this little, like, it's going to be like this one King Crimson album and this one Genesis album, and that's it, you know?
Brendan, what do you think, man?
It's I had the opposite reaction as our 80s episode, where after our episode, I came out of it with such a newfound love and appreciation for music of that decade. And with this, we picked the topic, and I'm like, yeah, I can get down with some prog. Man, I tried. I like sat in a room. I lit a candle. And it just did not take. So it is, it's not for me.
Lit a candle.
Freddie, David, you got any lasting comments here?
Yeah. My 14-year-old self loved a lot of this stuff. My current self, not as much, but I'm glad that I listened to it. I'm glad I went through that period. I'm glad I saw most of these bands live back in the day. And it was the time. That's all.
I hear you. Yeah. How about you, Dave? You got anything?
Yeah, I just want to say I think for me, if I can listen to something over and over again, maybe, and find some good things, eventually I'll find more good things in it. So I don't want to say that the prog thing is all. I think I'm probably somewhere between Brendan and Adam in this, where sometimes I'll roll my eyes and have to turn it off. And then other times, I think there's really some really impressive stuff that's really actually worth listening to. So I don't know. The jury's still out for me. I will say this: the name prog rock, there's something about that progressive rock. It's like kind of an oxymoron or something to me, and that may be one of the problems with why it's received like that. If you go about it just thinking of it as music or as an ensemble playing something, maybe it would be better received. I don't know. That's just a little
interesting.
That's very, very interesting point. And my lasting comment is, so personally, the way I like to listen to music and think about music is, and write music as a songwriter myself, is cutting the fat, usually. And this is the exact opposite of that. So I'm out on the prog rock, guys.
Did you already delete the playlist? Is the playlist deleted off your library already?
I threw it in the ocean. No. But I definitely want to thank David for coming on. Really appreciate being our first ever guest.
Thanks. A lot of great insight, a lot of great comments.
Definitely be on the lookout for his new album coming out in October. David, is there anything else you want to kind of like, plug or anything before we get out of here?
I'm mostly on Bandcamp these days with my stuff. There's a couple other albums on there that I've just been doing during sort of the quarantine pandemic stuff. Two of them, actually, speaking of prog rock, they're not really prog rock, but they're sort of concept albums related to staying at home and life during COVID. So there are those two albums that are out there, and some other little things that I've been writing on the Bandcamp. So you go to like bandcamp.com/DaveCope, you can probably find some of that stuff. Yeah, check it out. No prog really, but maybe some rock.
Yeah, great music. And our buddy Freddie actually played on Dave Cope and the Sass. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we.
Yeah, and we're still. We got some other things we're writing right now too.
Yeah, very cool.
Always writing.
Yeah. Very cool. Awesome music. Love having you on the show, man. Thanks. And come back again, and we're going to talk about something less proggy. For that, I will say thank you, Brendan, Freddie, Adam, and David. My name is Aaron Brown, the John Stockton of podcasts, and we will see you again very soon. Take care.
Right, fiction.